Okay, thanks. And I have to apologize, I guess, at least about three things. Ed, I'm sorry that I included these three buzzwords in my title, but I spared you a few others, which I'm not really going to mention. I'll do them in Kripa, but I'll not say the real word. But I'll try to, nevertheless, to explain and define what I'm going to talk about. And that's number one. Number two is that I'm not sure I'll really be able to explain to you what is nanoscience or why it is interesting to some. The real reason that it's interesting to me is because it's a branch of physics where you can sort of go into the place where quantum mechanics and statistical mechanics meet each other, this murky place where you really have to understand how things go in between. So as a theoretician, I think this is something that you like to really delve very deeply into, and that's what I'll try to do. The third apology is that most of what I'm going to talk about is in some sense very obvious, very well known. All of you should know it, and you know, and tell me, you know, why are you wasting our time? I mean, I would really love if you do that. I'd really love even more if you start to fight with me, which fortunately is the case when I give this similar talks in other institutions. Maybe the audience here is more, cultured, civilized, and will not do that. But if you tell me in the end that all I say is stupidly trivial and you have known it for many years, I'd be very, very happy.
And incorrect.
Pardon me?
And incorrect.
That's even better. Okay, so you know, I've used these three words. What is dissipation? I guess I do not have to understand. This is something everyone understands from everyday life. And a friend of mine gave a very good example. What is dissipation? You know, in the first day of the month, you have X dollars in your pocket. In the end of the month, you have minus Y without really doing anything. So things go from a small, well-defined system to some large reservoir and never come back. That's the daily definition of dissipation. Now, what is noise? Everyone knows what is noise. Nevertheless, maybe you don't know everything about noise. I think I'll have to use this and the board interchangeably. But if you're a classical physicist, you sure know what is noise. For example, you take some electrical circuit where there is a current flowing, and you look at this current as function of time, and you plot it. This is I, and this is T, and you have something like that. So there may or may not be an average current, but on top of this average current, there are temporal fluctuations, and people can just measure this function over arbitrary long times. And the question is how to get something fundamental, something that you can easily convert to easy things, and not just, you know, the whole function is not interesting. So the very good measure of these fluctuations is the correlation function, which after the influx of a Russian scientist, it's called correlator, maybe correlator or something like that. So the correlator is something like I of T prime, I of T. And since we're only going to talk about systems where the origin of time is not interesting, we're going to put here zero. So this is the correlation function of the noise. And everyone knows that this is something much more meaningful than to look at the whole stupid function. And now you can Fourier transform this thing, and it gives you something which I'll call S of omega. And S of omega, d omega, as you all know, is the power which this noise has within the frequency window d omega. So all this is beautiful. I just reminded you what classical physicists say about it. Now, when you go to quantum mechanics, things are not so simple, because now the current is an operator, and if the system by itself has an Hamiltonian which is time independent, you cannot measure, you know, there is no operator is a big thing. It has a lot of eigenvalues. You don't measure the value of an operator. You can measure an expectation value of an operator, but for a time independent system, this expectation value is constant. So you cannot talk about I of T. I average is not interesting. You can't talk about this. This is still a very meaningful quantity. because in fact this function will depend on time, even for a system whose Hamiltonian does not depend on time, and it's this function which gives you the information about the fluctuations in the system. However, now you run into a new problem which didn't exist in classical physics, namely that the operators I of t and I of zero and I of t do not commute. So what should you do? Should you take this order or the other order, or symmetrize or anti-symmetrize, or do some other thing which some people like to do? Anyway, this is a question. So the question is what to do about the fact that the measurement, and what physically this means, is if you measure here, this measurement will influence what will happen here. You cannot measure both of them with absolute accuracy because they are influencing each other. And this is not a trifle. This is a very important thing. And actually, it's the essence of the whole difference between quantum and classical physics. And one must be able to deal with it in a satisfying way. And somehow it's a trivial point, but even in the best textbook on statistical physics, this is a little bit swept under the rug. For example, in this textbook, which is really one I love and grew up with, it tells you, okay, these operators do not commute a different instance of time. What is the... And therefore, we must define the symmetrized product. So, you know, I agree with every word here except the word must. I mean, what is must?
Wrong translation.
I don't know if I put it on the slide. Yeah, this book was translated by Pyrles and Pyrles.
Sure. Of course, I recognize the superiority of Pyrles in physics, but not in Russian.
Well, this is Pyrles. Pyrles and Pyrles. No? Okay.
But I thought later in the book, later in the chapter, he actually derived the fluctuation dissipation theory.
Yes, which
I think then he uses the symmetrized form to do that. So.
Well, yeah. This will be a subject that will come later. Anyway, the word must is not a good word because, you know, if you have if this and this and the anti-symmetrized correlator are different, if you throw out one of them, you might have thrown, you know, part of the baby with part of the water, and you don't want to do that. And one of the points will be that you should not do that, and actually there is a lot of information in the two. For example, in the C of T, this is called the correlator, we'll call it C of T. There's a lot of information between in C of T and C of minus T, and actually they are not equal. So this is C of T. The Fourier transform of C of T is S of omega. Actually, you might be surprised. For example, if you take a system which is at equilibrium, and everything is known, C of T is not equal to C of minus T. It's a fact of life. I'll show it to you in a few minutes. And there are no philosophical questions with that. The direction of time is well defined in a system which is in equilibrium, as you will see in a few minutes. So this is one thing. Then there is one little skirmish in the mesoscopic, nanoscopic literature, which arises from some experiments. And while, you know, this should have been quieted down a long time ago, it is still raging. There is a controversy which is still raging, and people are still writing papers about it. And all this is really provoked by this experiment. Now, I'll define decoherence in a few minutes. A few, maybe even less, but there is something which is called the decoherence rate of things. For example, if you look at a conduction electron in a metal or in a conductor, this thing will not be coherent forever. And there are ways to measure it. I won't go into them. If there is any interest, I'll explain in more detail. And here is a measurement of this decoherence time as function of temperature for some systems, for some gold systems, and similar measurements were done in other systems. And this is the temperature axis. And you see that when temperature goes to zero, this decoherence rate or time seems to saturate it. So when you go to the zero temperature limit, although everything goes to the lowest possible state, still this electron has a finite coherence time, and you'll understand exactly what it means in a few minutes, but it's something very disconcerting because before this experiment, everybody thought that it should diverge, it should continue like this, and it didn't. So, what it means, it may mean many things. It may mean that there is something in the sample or in the experiment which needs checking, but instead of that, theoreticians started to there is a flow of theoretical papers, and this is one of them. We talk about things like quantum decoherence time. When the thermal effects become important, you have a fundamental consequence of zero-point fluctuations of electrons, which means that when everything goes to the ground state, still one electron doesn't stay coherent in the presence of all the others, which is somewhat strange, but this is backed by real calculations, and it's not the only one. Actually, there was a talk about it here, and we should have censored it out, but we don't because we believe in freedom of speech. See the names? Zero-point fluctuation, the quenching of persistent current. The zero-temperature environment can effectively destroy the coherence of the mesoscopic system. Okay, so this is, there are specific statements like that, and of course there are rebuttals, and it's still going on, and comments are being sent out almost every week, and it's really stupid because I'm going to show you there is nothing to talk about. This doesn't exist. There is nothing like decoherence by zero-point motion. And the question is how to stop this, and so I'll make another small contribution to that.
Proposal to stop, consider atom. Atom is the ground state. Is it coherent or not?
I mean, you should be careful in what you say. If you are in a quantum state, if you have an isolated system, if you have an isolated system in a ground state, by definition, a state is a state, it's psi of x and x1, x2.
Beautiful optical experience, like Ramsey oscillation and so on, there is no detection by vacuum.
Okay. Good.
Joe, this experiment of Morantz, how is the lowest temperature compared with the first excitation of this system?
Oh, it's okay. It's larger than the first excitation. Okay. Yeah, sure. Larger by a lot. Yes. Okay, so after this, I must define to you what I really mean by decoherence, and I know it was the subject of the competing program here, but we are
still... really zero temperature, I mean, this experiment.
Yeah, but it looks like it saturates, and then, you kind of extrapolate. What can you do,
Are you going to say something about the experiment of YDC?
Well, if there is time, I should say, before going into details, these experiments were done by probably one of the best groups in the field. Nevertheless, there are other groups, and there is also a debate on the experiment. And there are sample questions, and there are measurement technique questions, which are not totally clarified to this day. So I cannot make a judgment about the experiment except to tell you that the way this result is stated is against the laws of physics. So it's not our task to find exactly, what happened there. But before that, let me remind you what is actually this decoherence which everybody is talking about. So the best thing is to think about some kind of two-wave. The easiest and the first case where you have coherence is when you have a two-wave interference. Two waves are split and combined, and actually we have in our kind of physics a very nice way to probe that by putting here a field, a magnetic field, a Aronoff-Bohm field, and then you the transmission is the sum of this and that, and you have in the transmission three terms. You have, if the amplitudes are A1 and A2, you have A1 square average, A2 average absolute square, and this one. This is the interference term. And usually you say that the size of this term tells you how coherent the system is. So that's a good way to define, so if you could measure that and then do something which, and people now can do that, do something which will reduce this term, you will be able to control this decoherence, and this can be done. If there is time, I doubt if there will be, I can talk a little bit about a very nice example where people really had a knob that they could turn, and switch this guy up and down. Of course, Yigal can tell you even more about it because he did one of the three versions of the theory. But how is this coherence established? As I already said, if I have an isolated system, whatever it is, and it satisfies a wave equation, like an electron moving in some potential, electrostatic and magnetostatic potential, then there is a Schrödinger equation, a wave equation for this thing, and the wave equation just has a wave, and the wave is coherent, it has a wave function. It's a psi absolute value times e to the I-phi. There is no decoherence whatsoever. Let's first agree with that. Okay, so if you just throw one electron in some potential which has this form, this is the form of the wire, so the waveguides for this electron, no problem, there is never decoherence. In order to get decoherence, you must interact with what people call the environment. The environment means all the other degrees of freedom in the world, which you don't measure when you perform the interference experiments. So, for example, in the lattice, there are lattice vibrations, there are other electrons, there may be magnons or whatever. You interact with them. And due to this interaction, somehow you kill your coherent contribution to a measurable quantity. Now, there are two ways you can understand how this happens, and these two waves can be proven exactly to be equivalent, though that equivalence is not so obvious at all. And one of them is you say, okay, if I have two paths, and one path flip the environment to some state, psi environment one, and the other one psi environment two. If these two states are orthogonal, then when I measure the particle property, I have to trace over the environment, and then I have the trace over psi two and psi one. If they're orthogonal, I'll get zero. This term will be multiplied by zero. So this is one way to understand how this decoherence can occur. Another way to understand it, which sounds very different, is to say, okay, the environment is actually performing some fluctuations. The environment is a big system with a lot of stuff. It has something like that. You know, its density, its current are fluctuating. These fluctuating densities, currents, will give you some fluctuating potentials on the particle. And if you just wait enough time, these fluctuating potentials will result in a phase uncertainty, which would be so large that they will wash out this thing. Turns out you can prove without any words, that just the equations, that these two things are exactly equivalent. And you may wonder, how can it be? You know, one is what I do to the environment, and the other one is what the environment does to me. Sounds a little bit like that Newton's third law. And in fact, these two things are exactly mathematically equivalent. And if you think, what is the basic reason of that? It's something which is called the fluctuation dissipation theorem. The ability of this guy to excite, to dissipate energy into the environment becomes larger if the environment has more fluctuations. I'll quantify this statement very precisely a little bit later. I mean, all of you know what it is. And if there is time, I'll also show you a little generalization of this fluctuation dissipation theorem, which we find, and this is a work of done with Uri Gavish, who is here, and with Yoshua Levinson. We find a slight generalization of this fluctuation dissipation theorem beyond equilibrium, which I think is quite interesting, and if I have time, I'll get to it later. But anyway, so these two are equivalent, and it's just a reflection that if something is softer and fluctuates more, it's also easier to get too excited. Okay, so now we know what is decoherence, and as I said, there are certain interference effects in conducting metals or semiconductors, which enable you to measure the rate of this decoherence for electrons, and then you have this measurement which created some discussions. So far I've just, I think, presented you what are the questions that we want to discuss. I can have the lights on. I'll sort of switch on and off between these two issues of the noise and the decoherence, because you see they're very, very strongly related. The decoherence can be thought as brought about by the fluctuations of the environment, by the noise in the environment. So let's now go back to this question of the correlators and try to think, how can I measure such a correlator, or how can I measure this power spectrum of this correlator? So let's talk about something specific, which is what is really the problem at hand. We have some circuit which is connected to some terrible experimental system, and in this circuit there is a current. And this current, if it were classical, I could write a I of t, but I cannot, because this current is an operator. And when I say current, I mean the zero momentum, the q equals zero component, because you see in a minute we are interested in a coupling of this to electromagnetic fields, and there will be very large wavelength electromagnetic fields. So how can we characterize this this correlator, and in particular, how can we understand very clearly the difference between the two ways to order this correlator? It's very simple. You have to take one of your favorite quantum mechanics books, and for example, in Bain's book, you get almost the final result. This guy interacts with the electromagnetic field by integral of I dot A. A is more or less constant, so it's A times I of Q equals zero. If you want a process where the field excites this circuit, so this is the absorption spectrum, you just describe that perturbation by the Fermi golden rule, and you find that absorption is proportional to the following expression, which I'm just going to write, and I think you all will understand exactly what it means. And let me see what the sum is on. Omega is the frequency of the field. And there are some constant in front of it. I might not have been very careful about the science. You can define it this way or the other way. So absorption means that you go from a low state to a high state. And now the only thing you have to add here is Pi. Take a system which is known to be in some distribution of its eigenstates. I and F are the eigenstates of the system without the interaction to the field. Before the interaction, the initial state at the probability Pi. F is the final state. So this is just the Fermi golden rule for absorption. What is the Fermi golden rule for emission? Now I might have written the signs differently, but emission is the same with minus omega. So you see that this function, positive omega and minus omega, is just emission and absorption. Now it so happens that this function is exactly, and this is an exact statement, is exactly equal to the function which I called here S of omega. So this thing is just S of omega. It's the Fourier transform of the time-dependent correlation function of the current. The proof for that was done by these tens of people. I know the first version in a paper by Van Hove in 1954. And what you do is you do the following. I won't write all the steps on the board, but you can follow it if I say it in two sentences. You write this as 1 over 2 pi integral d time, and then you have it to the IEI time the time, to the minus IF times the time. When you put it here, you see you have two things. E to the minus IEI time is just the time dependent, is just E to the IHT operating here. On the F, it's just E to the plus IHT operating there. This gives you the exponentials here. So in one of these operators here, you have its time-dependent version. So what you have is a sum over I and F, pi, time is really traced over one of the states. Now you don't have a delta function anymore. Just have, the delta function is traded by these factors and by an integral, which is just the Fourier transform. So maybe I was a little quick, but I think I told you exactly how you can sit down and in 2-3 minutes derive that this is equal to the integral of C of t dt e to the minus I omega t from minus infinity to infinity. So that's good. So now we know that this correlator has a power spectrum, S of omega, and this S of omega is measurable. It's measurable if you perform emission absorption experiment on your system. And what I say now is totally general. You know, it's just valid for any system you would like, with interaction, without interaction, Kondo effect, whatever, nucleus, particle, solid state. This is it. This is an exact relationship. And so one side of S of omega is the emission spectrum. So let's choose, you know, put the sign so that omega positive is the emission spectrum. And omega negative in the absorption spectrum. And that's it. So now you see that the function, it's not really such a good idea to symmetrize the correlator, because the symmetrized correlator will lead to half the emission plus the absorption. And in doing that, you throw out the small difference that exists sometimes between emission and absorption. And you know, you guys know what this difference is. This difference is the net absorption. And the net absorption is the conductance of the system, is the dissipation. Maybe I was too fast, I'll return to it in a few minutes. But you see, I just recited for you the fluctuation dissipation theorem. The absorption minus the emission from a classical field is the net dissipation. So actually, if you accept these words, you find that the conductance of the system, G of omega. Now, see, this is now already a big step. Conductance is proportional to S of minus omega minus S of omega. And then it turns out, if you do it correctly, there is an omega there, because you have to take the to go from emission, from absorption to conductance, there are factors of omega floating around. Now, what is this? This is the Fourier transform of the commutator, of the thing that you threw out. So this is F of Fourier transform of I of zero, I of t. What is this? You know what this is. This is the Kubo formula. Kubo formula, fluctuation dissipation theorem, more or less the same thing. And it's as simple as that. It just tells you that the net absorption is the full absorption minus the full emission. And this really gives you a strong role to be played by the fact that this correlation function is not symmetric. It's not symmetric, it's inherently not symmetric, because were it symmetric, you would lose a lot of interesting things. A good question for you to think at home, not now, is the following. Let's go to the classical limit. I mean, the classical limit, clearly there is conductance. You know, classical system have dissipation, have conductance. Now, I told you that this asymmetry is due to quantum mechanical effect, to non-commutativity. How is it that I get an absorption in the classical limit, a net absorption? Think about it. And you will see that in the classical limit, it turns out that the absorption, classical limit is the limit where kT, you know, for an equilibrium system, if you think about equilibrium, is much larger than omega. You just have to understand the symmetry properties of this function, and you will see that there is a nice, you know, kT and omega game, that when you take the limit of kT over omega goes to infinity, it gives you a finite result. So in the classical limit, and I say it again, read my lips. If you disagree, come back, you know, and hit me. In the classical limit, the absorption is nevertheless a kind of relic of the commutator. Okay? If anybody wants to disagree, please do it now, while I'm still hot about it. Okay, so let's keep this in mind. Now you see, once you understand this, I think this fluctuation dissipation theorem, it becomes very, very obvious, very, very sort of intuitively appealing. And now you can start, you know, sort of scratching your head and thinking, okay, I know we know it in equilibrium system. What about being a little bit, you know, ambitious and going beyond the equilibrium systems? Can we do that? Now, of course, there is a kind of folklore in statistical physics that the fluctuation dissipation theorem is valid only for equilibrium systems. And actually, I mentioned this about a year and a half ago in a lecture in Holland, and one of the all-time statistical mechanics people was sitting there, and he jumped, and then he sat down and I think started to smile. I'm now going to tell you, because I'm very eager to do that, that this relationship is not necessarily an equilibrium relationship. There are a lot, many cases of non-equilibrium systems where you can, once you understand this, you can easily write generalizations of the fluctuation dissipation theorem beyond equilibrium. And philosophically, it's of interest because I told you before that, see, this is all very intimately related to the decoherence problem. I told you before that decoherence can be understood in two ways, in what I do to the system, what the system does to me via its fluctuations. Now, that proof is not only in equilibrium, it's much more general than that. So understanding the decoherence problem already tells you that there are relationships of this nature that are valid much beyond equilibrium physics. So I'm not at all surprised by this, and I'm going now to show you a clear example which immediately you see how it's generalizable to a large class of non-equilibrium systems. And you know, this is now something that personally I happen to like very much, which is called the Landauer transport picture. You know, the transport of electrons in solids is not an easy subject. I mean, this is the canonical way to treat conductance. But there is another way, which is actually very suitable for small systems like nano and meso and so on, suggested by Rolf Landauer many years ago. And it's very, very ingenious. It's much less mathematically rigorous, but it enables you to get a lot of new insights. And he said the following. He said, after all, a finite resistance we know at low temperatures. We are interested now in low temperatures in sort of close to the quantum limit. We know that resistance is due to scattering by impurities. What is the simplest case of an impurity? Let's take a one-dimensional line and put a little scatterer on it. So this scatterer can be, doesn't have to be just a square potential barrier. It can be a DNA molecule with some nanotube and all sorts of things that are entangled. Now I said this word around this line. And what it really means is that when the electron comes here, it can be transmitted, but it can also be reflected. And what Landauer told us, he sort of developed the whole physical picture, the result of which is that the same conductance that I wrote there, and now it talks about the DC limit, the omega equals zero limit, is just equal to, in 1D, but it's very easy to generalize to finite thickness realistic wires, but I write you the simple thing, is equal to just universal constant times the transmission coefficient of this object. This object can be as complicated as it is, but it's embedded in a one-dimensional wire, and therefore there is a single number, the transmission coefficient. If you put it in some other wire, this single number becomes a scattering matrix or scattering cross-section. But that's just a technical thing. This really has the essence. This is called the Landauer formula. And the physics, how he derives it, is very simple. He says, how do I get a transport, a non-equilibrium transport configuration? I somehow connect this wire to some big electron reservoir and do the same here. Experimentalists do this by soldering a little dot of tin or soldering material, I guess, on the top of the wire. This is my simplistic way to understand it. And now you put a voltage between these two so-called how it called ohmic contacts, right? It's called an ohmic contact. which is a simplified version of what they do. I don't know, you connect a battery between them, and what it means is the electrochemical potential here is a little bit higher than electrochemical potential there. So this is mu right and mu left. And what you find is that if you are at zero temperatures, to take it, take the most quantum thing, there is only a band of energies between mu left and mu right where electrons can flow, and each electron in this band sees the barrier, and only part of it gets transmitted. The part which gets transmitted is the current, and that's it. So you just write down a few little things. And so this is a manifestly non-equilibrium system, which you can sort of express the current. You know, G is the voltage, which is mu left minus mu right. And V over I is the current, is G. So now suppose I take such a system. I take a system with a finite current flowing. And in such a system, there is really great interest. And some of this interest is due to Matthew and Charlie Kane, who was also here before. The interest is that there is something called shot noise. Shot noise is something which you can think is really dirty engineering stuff. You know, it's noise which is like the hiss in your radio. But shot noise is the current is the same thing. Is the noise which for us is just this I of zero, I of t. In the state where there is a finite current flowing, with finite current. Noise in equilibrium is understood now for about 8 years following Nyquist and Johnson. When there is a current flowing, there is an additional kind of noise called sometimes non-equilibrium noise. Usually it's called shot noise or flicker noise or no, something else. And it's just due to the fact that this current, if it's carried by the classical picture of it, again, is this current, which is can be misleading, this current is carried by particles. It's not a continuous fluid. So the current that you get, if you integrate the current over a certain time, that quantity will fluctuate. It's like when you sit in a room with a tin roof and there is rain coming, you hear these knocks of the raindrops on your roof. The number of knocks per second is fluctuating. This is shot noise. I actually learned about it from a paper by Doug, written 34 years ago. I read it only 27 years ago. Well, it's
a Joseph's injunction, I think.
Yeah, it's good to sort of, everybody is a masochist a little bit. That's what I'm talking about. Okay. So this is called shot noise. Now the shot noise is very interesting because if you do that with finite current, you find that this thing or the S of omega of it is proportional to the charge of the current carrier. And you know that there are some strange cases, especially in condensed matter physics, that are known, but maybe also quarks and others, where you have things that are not integral charges. For example, in the fractional quantum Hall effect, there are supposed to be quasi-particles which charge one-third, one-fifth, etc. And Matthew and Charlie wrote a paper something like 8 years ago suggesting that if you could measure their shot noise, you'll be able to determine their charge. And actually, this experiment was performed at the same time by Weitzman group and by Saclay group, and found first the third charge. What is even more amazing is later our group also measured in the two-fifth state and found the one-fifth charge in agreement with theory. This is really very impressive. To be honest, these experiments also suggested a large number of new questions which are not understood, but at least you can measure the charge of a charge carrier using noise. That's actually very useful. And again, for those of us who are a little bit less young, I would say, it's very, very surprising because I remember very clearly in this place, in the other building many years ago, there was a paper by Sue Higger and Schrieffer on polyacetylene that had also a charge third, and it was suggested that this can be measured by shot noise, and this was immediately shot down by the experts Because they say, look, I mean, how do you measure this? You have this system, your current is going into this ohmic contact, ohmic blob. Of course, when the quasi-particle comes here, it gets dressed and becomes an electron. So the charge that you accumulate here is always an electron. So how the hell can you measure this charge third, which is not alive at the point where you measure it? Actually, for me, this was a very important consideration, because to be honest, I was quite skeptical about this charge third, whether it can be measured. And it was measured, it was clear, absolutely clear, you know, that it's not collecting the charge that accumulates in this contact. In spite of what you might have thought, and in spite of the classical idea that you just take currents and measure the current fluctuations. So actually, this is, you know, a fundamental interest of this is that noise measurements in quantum systems do not really measure accumulated charges. They measure something much more complicated, but there, at least there is one particular picture that we can write down on the board and defend, which is that if you look at it by a weak probe, electromagnetic field, measure emission and absorption, then what you measure is not the current fluctuations, but the field fluctuations, the field produced by the current. So what I told you here, that the, where it is written, okay, that the correlator is just the Fredholm sum of the emission absorption. The emission absorption has to do with field which emanates from the system itself, not when the electrons arrive at the point contact. And I think this is the real reason why this broken charge can be measured, in spite of what many people said. And I think I don't see now any reason why it couldn't be measured for other systems that have a fractional charge. But you see, if once you accept that, it sort of hits you and shows you that what you measure when you make noise measurements is not accumulating a certain number of electrons, because then it would convert into electrons, and there is no, I don't think there is a way around it. So first of all, you know, this was just a sales pitch for shot noise and for how useful it is. So okay, so now one wants to understand this shot noise, and the first thing I want to tell you, I won't tell you very much about shot noise. I tell you how consideration of this immediately shows you a non-trivial generalization, simple but non-trivial generation of the fluctuation dissipation theorem, which we like to call FDT, not to say these difficult words all the time. And picture now a case where you put a finite voltage here. So now this, for linear transport, mu left minus mu right is very, very small, goes to zero. Now we have a finite voltage and there is a certain current. And what our experimentalist friends do is they measure something which is called IV characteristic, which usually goes something like that. So it's not linear, it has things, you know, it's sometimes kind of wiggles. It's a very interesting thing. Now, so the proper generalization of the FDT to, you know, systems that can be quite far from equilibrium is to prepare the system here. No, this people call operating point of this system, finite voltage, finite current flowing to the system. I repeat, finite current flowing to the system. And now you just apply what I told you, and you find immediately that if you take the AC, this is a DC constant current. If you take the AC response, you wiggle now, in addition to the DC field, you add a little AC field here, at frequency omega, and you look at the slope of this, not the slope of the IV, the slope may or may not be the same, it's probably the same, but that I don't know, but you now look at the slope of the I at frequency omega versus V of frequency omega, that slope is the absorption of energy from the AC field, and that slope is exactly equal to the asymmetric part of your shot noise spectrum. This shot noise spectrum is not an equilibrium property. Everything is out of equilibrium, can be seriously out of equilibrium, still okay. And actually, when you think a little bit about this, you can find, you know, the condition that you can do all that is something very innocuous. Any system which is driven in some way And I can say that after the driving, the system gets into some steady state where its quantum states, which were defined, were it isolated, have probabilities pi. Namely, if the density matrix, which describes the system in this non-equilibrium state, is already diagonal, which means that all these relaxations that kill the non-diagonal terms have occurred already, for that system, you can always write such a generalization of the FDP. So this is one small message I wanted to get across. I'd like now to maybe end by trying to... Do I have still 15 minutes? So I'll take 5 minutes to show you, first of all, the physics, what is wrong with the zero temperature decoherence, and then try to give you a proof of that. But I think so actually this is something that is really very I was provoked into finally saying that loudly, because I always thought that the players in this game should understand these things, and somehow they don't, and somehow one must now say it, and how to say it is another matter. But let me now take a very simple question, which was actually discussed by people who are a little bit higher than us. And I think the first guy to have discussed this question probably was Mr. Bohr. And you all heard, and I'm sure that maybe even in the last few months, about the famous Bohr discussions about diffraction from fluctuating slits. So, this is even difficult to draw. So I'd like just to take something simpler. So you have two scatterers now. You can think in a minute about a periodic array of scatterers. It's good enough. And you send here a wave, plane wave, and you have here a screen. And because of this screen, you have two scatterer diffraction, which is very much like a two-slit interference. The intensity on the screen will do something like that. I'm sorry, I didn't draw it correctly. It will also have it will go like that. Now, it would be a very nice way to define experimentally decoherence, because now if you let these guys interact with environment, for example, perform vibrations, then it will reduce the amount of this interference. And on the other hand, there will be a classical part, which is independent of angle, provided these are S-wave scatterers, that will survive. So again, let's discuss this in the simplest approximation as A1 square plus A2 square plus twice real part A1, A2 star. So now, said Mr. Niels Bohr, let's embed each of these scatterers in harmonic oscillator potential. So I don't know how to draw it, but say they are moving along this axis. There is a little harmonic oscillator potential here, little harmonic oscillator potential there. And let's say that the system is at zero temperature. And I hope you understand this is space and this is energy. Each of these guys is sitting in the lowest harmonic oscillator state. And now you see that you may, and actually people have done that, now you can jump and say, so you have been cheating us all the time, because it's clear, without doing any calculation, that if this harmonic oscillator potential is soft enough, is floppy enough, then, each of these scatterers will sort of have huge excursions, and because of that, you will wash out the interference term. And it's even true. But I'm not, I think that I'll probably, give up and say, all I told you is wrong. Here is a case where a zero-point motion can make decoherence because it can decrease the interference. And I'm not saying that. I'm saying it doesn't. So what is happening here? What is happening is something trivial for those who knows what it is, and it was understood by all sorts of nice gentlemen in the 30s, 40s, 50s. And it's very sad that all this knowledge has been forgotten and people still write Keldysh technique calculations and so on, which demonstrate misunderstanding of this. So let's first understand, you know, what is happening here. You know, so what is happening if you look at some, you know, some direction theta, you have a scattering vector, you know, k, which is the initial k minus the final k. And what you have to do is you know, what this has, of course, as you all know, I don't need this anymore. So I write this interference term as you know, it's e to the I k dot. I call this coordinate x. So just kx, x1 minus x2. Now we are in quantum mechanics. These guys are performing zero-point fluctuations, and this is what determines the interference term. In fact, this thing is decreasing because this k, this x1 and x2, each of them is a Gaussian variable. This will be something like, it's e to the minus, this is proportional to e to the minus kx squared times x1 squared average plus x3 average. Just the zero-point fluctuations of the two scatterers. If these fluctuations are much larger than the relevant wave number, the interference is being lost more and more. And this is not very, very sophisticated. It's just the fact that if you have diffraction from a distributed diffractor, then you have it's like an antenna theory. You have just a superposition of all the wavelets coming from all the parts of this distributed scatterer, and you get this. And if you are now very, very superficial, which people have been, and you say, if I do the same, now don't forget that there are also these classical terms. Now you might think that the classical terms are not killed. Why? Because the classical term has no phase shift. It's just e to the ix kx1 minus x1. So when the scatterer is moving, for any point the scatterer is, there is really nothing like that. You don't care about that. So you may say that these things stay put, and this thing is getting killed by this effect, which is called in the solid state literature the bipolar factor, which gives you some idea how long ago it was done. And these do not have the bipolar factor because this doesn't have a k dot x. It has that k dot x1 minus x1, so it's nothing, it's zero. And here comes the big misconception, big misunderstanding. It's true that, and this is actually now we have to start to discuss scattering from one fluctuating guy. Now, the total scattering from this guy doesn't care what he's doing, except for some small things which I'll be glad to discuss later. It remains the same. However, when the guy can fluctuate, the scattering develops inelastic portions. In other words, this guy sits in a harmonic oscillator potential. There's levels. You can excite all these levels. This was calculated by two gentlemen, one called Tzemach and one called R.J. Glauber, 1953. They did the whole calculation, very simple. And it's clear that the sum of all, under some condition, the sum of everything is constant. But the elastic part of the scattering gets decreased a lot. And the elastic part of the scattering from one static scatterer gets knocked down by a very similar bipolar factor. So there is another thing, which is e to the minus x1 squared average. But where does it come in? It didn't come in the naive calculation that sort of intentionally did wrongly and presented to you here. And now comes the crux of the matter. The crux of the matter is that if you talk about electrons on the Fermi sphere, which is what you do in metals at low temperatures. If your harmonic oscillator is in the ground state, there is no inelastic scattering because the electrons cannot give energy that they don't have. They cannot go down from being on the Fermi sphere below because of Mr. Pauli. And of course, the oscillator cannot give them energy. So if this is, if you have just a scatterer going into space, you'll be able to excite this and go down in energy and satisfy the scattering sum rule. If the scatterer happens to be a Fermi particle on the Fermi sphere, you lose all the inelastic scattering and you have only elastic scattering. And then you have to do some calculations and you find that the elastic scattering gets killed by the same thing exactly. So what has happened, the zero-point fluctuations do not produce real decoherence. What is real decoherence? Real decoherence is when you have classical terms and interfering terms, and they are both decoherence is when the classical terms stay and you kill this part. But if you kill the whole thing, what you have done, you just renormalize the scattering of each of the scatterers. And when you make measurements on the conductance of metals at low temperatures, you already are sensitive to the renormalized scattering. So it's you know, you live in a world where this renormalization is already being applied, and therefore, once you express things in terms of the measured cross-sections, nothing happens. The ratio of this and that stay the same when the temperature goes to zero.
Joe, could I ask you?
Yes,
is your
please.
Conclusion applying equally well to fermions and bosons or just fermions? Because
what I said is about elastic scattering. Whatever it is, you know, if you, for example, there is a nice example that, I don't know if you know Harry Lipkin. I told him about that and he really suggested a very nice example. Suppose I do it with a photon. Now I have a photon scattering from two harmonic oscillators and I just choose the frequency of the oscillator to be larger than the energy of the photon. The oscillator is zero temperature. They cannot give energy to the photon. If the photon is an energy smaller than the photon frequency, it cannot excite the oscillator. So you are doomed to have only elastic scattering. And once you have done that, you get the same. So
it's a question of a spring constant in some sense. If the spring constant is weak enough, you can get in some trace left
It's that, and it's a question.
If not, then they are safe. And
I would say it's a question of available phase space for inelastic scattering. If you kill it, there is no decoherence whatsoever. Now,
in one case you killed the phase space with the photon, it's killed energetically.
And there are many tricks you can you can just put a energy filter that will not There is an interesting question: what happens to all the part that you lost? And it can do a number of nice things. It can either go in the forward direction, or in some cases in solid state, it can renormalize your mass and give you a heavier particle, which is called the Polaron effect, which is also a very interesting subject and has been sort of glorified with buzzwords recently. But that's another matter. I just want to take 3 minutes to outline for you how. These maybe you think that all this is very non-rigorous and intuitive, although I don't see what is non-rigorous in the fact that an electron at the Fermi level cannot lose energy, or that a harmonic oscillator in the ground state cannot give energy. Now I should also I shouldn't do that, but I know that there is a conference in Southern California soon called on quantum corrections to the second law of thermodynamics. And I wanted to write them a note saying that I don't come to conferences on subjects that do not exist. So these things are ironclad, but I'm sure you want to see some mathematics, let me give it to you, but I won't write it on the board. What is really decoherence in a more systematic sense? Let's suppose I have a particle whose states are denoted by I. This is my probe particle. I'll finish in 3 minutes. I just want to say something and show you another proof, quote unquote, about these things. And then I have some environment whose states are denoted by S. S is for system, but that's my own where I have to do this. So what is decoherence? Decoherence means that you start your system at time equals zero when a particle has is in state I, so it's phi I of the particle times psi s of the system. You start the system in a product state. Now you switch on an interaction between the particle and the system. So this will go to itself, to phi I psi s plus a sum over j and t of alpha I alpha j t t t has two roles here, but you won't be confused. And then it's phi j psi t. So I don't want to use the dirty word that some of you will call this this thing compared to that thing. But what you are doing is when you interact with the environment, you start with a pure state and you sort of add to it some complications arising from the interaction. And what this decoherence really means, the decoherence rate is nothing but the rate for this thing to build up. So the rate, you have to look at the quantity sum over j of alpha j t of t square. At time equals zero, it was zero. It will increase. Maybe after a very long time, it will go to unity, and it will mean that your initial product state has completely deteriorated and went into that messy thing. You want to normalize it correctly, sure. I know, I'm very schematic. Now, the rate at which this grows, or maybe the rate at which 1 minus that falls from 0, from 1 to 0, is the decoherence rate, because of just what I told you in the beginning. There is nothing more to it, that if you take different environment state and you measure only the particle, you have to trace, and different states give you 0 because they are orthogonal. You just have to calculate that rate. And you can just sit down and calculate that rate. And the interesting thing is that you have also to average over somehow, for reasons that I honestly do not fully understand, I can only do it if I average over something which we call the ensemble of disorder in the case that I'm interested in, which is a metal. You get a very nice expression for the dephasing rate, which is very general. And I just write it to you and show you why it demonstrates zero dephasing. I use dephasing and decoherence in an interchangeable manner. Maybe it's not nice, but it's given by the following. It's one, and this is an exact result. H cube times the volume of the system, integral d3 cube, integral d omega, now comes a new function. Okay, first comes the interaction vq square. Vq is the Fourier transform of the interaction between the particle and the system, of course, obviously. And now you have something very interesting, which is called S particle of q and omega, S system of minus q and minus omega. These S's are very much like the S of omega I had here. You see, here you may remember I looked at the current fluctuations and took q equals zero and just had one variable omega. Here, this is actually the power spectrum of n, if you like, of q and t. This is the particle density q component at time t. So this is called the density. In X and T, it's called the density correlator of the system. And it satisfies the same rules as the one of the ones of the current. I mean, the theory is very much the same. And actually, Mr. Van Hove, who did it first, he really introduced these guys for the density, not for the current. But he can go from one to the other. There is no problem. Now, this is all. This is all that there is to it. And physically, it's totally obvious because it says that you sum over all channels where you transmit omega and q between the particle and the system, and this one gives omega q, this one takes omega q. Once you do this, you immediately see, you know, very, very vividly why, in the limit that both of the particle and the system go to their t equals zero, to the temp, to their ground state, to the limit of very vanishing excitation energy, why this integral must vanish. The reason is that at equilibrium, now we do this at equilibrium, and again, if you talk about linear transport in a metal, the linear transport coefficient, according to Mr. Kubo, and FDT is an equilibrium correlator. At equilibrium, there is a condition that S Q in omega is e to the minus beta H bar omega. Beta is 1 over K Boltzmann T times S of minus Q minus omega. This is called the detailed balance condition. And it's really a relation between the positive omega and negative omega portions of such a function. This is really why in equilibrium they must be not symmetric in omega or in time. And it's basically because, you know, the ability to take energy and to get energy are not equal, and they depend on temperature in a very well-defined way. This is very much like the Einstein relation. You can philosophize about this for centuries. Anyway, because of this, you see that each of these functions, one of its branches goes to zero at zero temperature. The branch of the function SQ and omega, which is emission, goes to zero. But notice that there is omega here and minus omega there. So the support of this product goes to zero in the t equals zero limit, because one of them is non-zero at positive omega and the other one is non-zero at negative omega. The only exception to this, which I should have discussed from the very beginning, is if, for example, that's the only relevant thing, if the environment to interact with has large degeneracy of the ground state, then this could have a delta function at omega, and if one of them is finite and the other one is a delta function, you can get a finite result. But that we know that if system has degeneracy of the ground state, like uncompensated magnetic moment, then you can make inelastic scattering, you can just flip this magnetic moment and create decoherence. So that's no big news. If you rule that out by assumption, and it basically is that, there are really not so many examples of systems that will have this degeneracy in the t equals zero limit. I don't think I know more than one very, very elaborate example, which probably also fails, in real life will also fail at very low temperatures. Anyways, for normal systems, no ground state degeneracy, 1 over tau phi goes to 0 when t goes to 0. That's it. So I think what I try to do is sort of maybe a little bit entangled in the two discussions of noise and decoherence and the dissipation of causes in the fact that you transfer energy from one system to another, but this is the simplest part. I try to sort of give you some flavor. What happens to all these things in the limit of very low temperature, which is the system where, so you see, I think always about a little system, a little quantum dot or something, or Fullerene or whatever, and it goes to the zero temperature, as close as you can to the zero temperature limit. And then there is some simplicity which achieved in all these things. These power spectra become very, very skew, and to symmetrize them is really not a bright idea when one part of it is zero. And much of the errors, by the way, in the calculations are done by using symmetrized versions of these guys, which really throw the baby with the water, as I said. So that's what they have, and there are many interesting results, one of which is that the coherence does vanish in all systems where inelastic scattering between the particle and the environment is somehow killed. That's a general condition. It includes electrons in metals, which is the case of interest to us. And I hope also you appreciate a little more the symmetries of the power spectrum and what they tell you. And my own general happiness about this is that I think somehow the measurement of quantum noise, I think I understand it correctly now, it's not measuring I of t, because there is no such a thing. There is no such a thing as I of t in a quantum system with a time-independent Hamiltonian. You have to measure the correlator, and the easiest way to measure the correlator, there are hundreds of other ways, is by looking at S of omega and measuring it via absorption emission. And then it's not symmetric, and leads to a lot of things, but the philosophical statement is that it's now clear why you can address systems, and if systems have interesting non-trivial quasi-particles such as charge third or fifth, and you make a measurement of the noise produced by the system, then you can measure it, in spite of what everybody has thought 20 or 25 years ago. Thank you very much.
I have two questions. One, first, it's more of a clarification about the first one. You said, the way I understand it, at least what the computational dissipation theorem tells me is that if I know the conductance, which is measured in linear response as a function of omega, for example, then measuring the noise at equilibrium does not give me any new information. Are you saying that if I'm out of equilibrium and I know the conductance, I mean the gradient of I versus V as a function of omega, short noise will not give me new information? I mean, this relation still holds?
Well, you know, I've not talked about the full short noise. I've talked about let me go back. First of all, there is a question which I avoided, and I only mentioned very weakly, the question of whether the low frequency AC absorption is the same as the slope of the DC characteristics. In many cases, it is the same. There are many cases where systems can have a delta of omega, you know, portion of the response. If there is such a thing, then you know, the slope of the DC and the AC in the limit omega goes to zero may not be the same. Now, usually these things would be smeared by something of real life, but you must always be very, very, very aware of the fact that such Fourier transform of correlators can have anomalies at zero. The best example for that is actually the what is called the structure factor of a liquid. You know, you measure X-ray scattering from a liquid, and you know that you have no break peak, no nothing. But if you take the Q equals zero limit, then there is a theorem that the Q equals zero limit is the compressibility. You know, the other end, the Q equals zero limit is trivial because all these e to the IQ X's are one. So it just n squared, where n is the number of particles. So the Q equals zero limit is not equal to the value at Q equals zero. And I suspect, although I don't know, but I think that there may be such anomalies also the omega equals zero limit. And you, of course, there are cases where it happens. No, whether it happens zero or not, I don't know, honestly.
About this, what you've just written on the board,
this one, yeah.
The phasing. It looked to me like you, or maybe I will ask, are you assuming that the electron that is in the environment are two separate entities?
Well, I'm assuming a system where there is something, and you shoot an electron on the Fermi level from outside, and you measure the current by how well this electron can be transmitted. Now, this is one picture. The other picture is using a Fermi liquid description of the metal, which is questionable. You know, I mean, some people question it. It's not really questionable. We don't know so many real cases where it's really broken, except, you know, of course, it's broken superconductivity, two-channel condor, whatever. But, you know, the same thing will happen for the quasi-particle, because the quasi-particle is assumed to be decoupled from the system in the limit of low energy, low temperature, low energy. What this calculation shows is that this assumption under quite general cases is valid, because the scattering rate of this guy from the environment will vanish unless there is some strange phenomenon such as ground state degeneracy. Of course, if there is a gap, like in superconductivity, things go wrong because there are just no quasi-particles there, right? But if there are quasi-particles, and if, unless the density of state of the system has a really strong anomaly at zero energy, which can happen. You know, the easiest case is a delta function because of two states of spin, right? And there can be more interesting things. If you could have a lattice in minus one dimension, the density of states, I think, will go like 1/(ω³). You know, you can cook up a lot of things, but normal systems whose density of states goes to zero, I don't remember now the exact condition. I think it's slower than 1/(ω).
For a one-dimensional interacting electron system, this argument presumably must break.
Yeah. So now one dimension, you know, exactly, because they do not satisfy Fermi liquid theory, and the reason is that, you know, one dimension has too many states at low energy. And you know, there is a older model in one dimension, which is, you know, just you take the one-dimensional crystal, and you know, you look at such things at the bi-Wohler factors. The bi-Wohler factor is zero. Why? Because there are many, many low-energy modes. So it's when you have too many low-energy modes, things can go bad on you. And I fully accept. I don't, you know, with some thought, we can write down the exact condition. But any case, and that's perhaps another good case. I'm not an expert on that. Any case where the effective density of states of the system has strong enough anomaly near the origin, and also the interaction parameter. So, you know, it's the interaction square and things. When that is anomalous, you know, this integral
can break down.
You know, if the integral goes like 1/(ω), it's good enough. So, and that happens, but it happens only in very, very special systems, and usually under very exacting conditions, because, you know, once you go a little bit away from 1D, I think it will not happen. You know, if you go from, certainly if you go to 2D, I mean, as far as we know, it won't happen. So, it's not a theorem in the sense that every system in the world, this will be zero, but I think what it tells you is the only way it can be non-zero is by having some quite anomalous structure, which can happen, and there are cases for that. I think they are related to each other somehow, where, you know, this thing is really anomalous enough to give you a finite contribution. But, you know, you cannot argue around this, and you cannot argue around that. This is, you know, these are the laws of the game. And I think it's good to understand, you know, precisely, you know, what we are talking about. That's all I was trying to say. Maybe, you know, I agree with you that there are a few very interesting models. Usually they are quite, you know, they're good. I mean, cleverly, one can make systems that will satisfy them. But it's not the thing you go and buy in the supermarket. It's not even, no, maybe it is still a nanotube, you know, maybe a nanotube can do it, but it, no, it's, first of all, it's finite, it has a level spacing, so, you know.
I want to come back to this question of where you see the fractional charge and the old argument with Mystic. See, my memory was that you wanted to look, if you drove that system, where the dissipation was going to be, and, that's where you were going to then see the noise from. And I think the impedance of the structure you write down is such that it's not occurring over on the edges, which is a way of telling where you can look. I think it's a problem of the impedance of the structure.
Sure, sure. I mean,
if you make the structure with the right impedance, if you come right in, as you say, and measure.
Yes, of course.
I think that was the argument at the time that it was missed, was I didn't understand that you had to look at the circuit impedance of the actual device.
Right. Yeah, you know, you're, I mean, the way I describe it, yeah, I agree with you.
People who were looking at the fractional charge were not circuit people a long time ago.
Yeah, you see, this is, you know, when I started my talk here, I said, you know, we are between quantum mechanics and StatMech now. We are not students anymore, unfortunately, but students tend to learn one course, forget it, and then learn the other. You must remember your circuit theory when you do these things.
Okay, well, let's thank Joe for coming on.